Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Two Nordies podcast. I'm your host, James, and I'm joined by my good friend, Timmy Long.
Hi, everyone.
Ron is on the deck. Say hi, Ron.
Hi, Ron.
And this week, we have the reigning Irish featherweight champion with a professional record of 14-1, and you have 5 All-Irelands, and you're from Kildare, and you've got great teeth.
You're very welcome. Keep going.
You're very welcome to the podcast, Eric.
Thanks, James. Thanks to me. Thanks for having me, lads.
Yeah, thanks for coming down to meet us. I just want to start off by saying, anyway, you did great during the summer and the Olympic coverage on RT.
Thanks very much. Like, it was great, wasn't it? Like, just the Olympics are, they're special, like, you know, and
especially the boxing.
Boxing, sure. Like, it's the kind of every amateur boxer's dream to box in the Olympic Games, and it's the kind of platform and exposure that they get. But sadly, only every 4 years in this country we wake up to the boxing. But they're doing it year in, year out across the world in Europeans, world championships, you know, picking up medals and representing us on the big stage. And but, you know, to be involved with it was brilliant. And the feedback, yeah, was great. So thanks for that.
Yeah, no, you did really well. The whole panel did well. You know, Kenny and the lads in the studio, the commentator, I said, beforehand, you know, he really kind of has set the atmosphere. But I remember watching Kelly in the final and I was at home watching on my phone because it was early, you know.
Yeah.
And I haven't cried for years. I cried when she won that. I mean, no, like, not like a little wet eye. I'm talking about tears.
This is a big moment, you know, Eric.
Yeah.
This is a big moment. James is actually saying he actually got emotional and cried. Like,
yeah, I'm not really surprised, honestly, because a lot of people did. The amount of people that got in touch with me, you know, big, strong GA men as well, managers and everything that told me they were crying.
I wonder what it is about that moment that touched so many people, you know?
I think it was Kelly. People just related to her, connected to her. She's just a genuine, she's a gem.
Yeah.
She's an absolute gem and she wears her heart on her sleeve. Yeah. And she's, you know the way sometimes when you look at say celebrities or sports stars and that, you don't feel really connected to them. Like they're in a kind of, you know, a different, you put them in a different place, maybe on a pedestal or whatever.
Yeah.
But Kelly is just like your neighbor. The girl next door, you know?
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
And I think people could just like relate to her in that way and connect to her. And
yeah, she was so genuine, wasn't she?
Absolutely amazing, yeah.
But the performance as well, like she lost the first round and then to kind of dominate for the next two rounds. Like it was like she had it up. No, it was brilliant.
It was incredible. It's up there with one of the best ever Olympic performances from any athlete, you know? This girl that she boxed, Beatrice Ferreira, undefeated for 2 years, reigning world champion, knockout artist. Done a number on a girl that beat Kelly, you know, a good few times. The Mira Potkonen from Finland. So you can imagine going into this fight, but very daunting, you know. And then to go in there and deliver like that. It was class. It was pure class. Because sometimes, you know, we're known as a small nation with a big heart. But technically, we just don't live up to the expectations with these people. We've big heart and we'll fight all day. But technically, we're not sound enough. But Kelly was exceptional on that day. Left, right, southpaw, orthodox, what way you wanted it. Absolutely incredible. And she made a girl who looked unbeatable look pretty ordinary in the end. And that, to me, shows.
Even in the last level. Two rounds, the 5 judges gave a 10-9 across the board. No, it wasn't even close. Like,
no, it was unanimous, it was class. I'm so happy for her.
But you know, for pardon the pun, but we punch above our weight.
We do.
For the size of the island that we have.
We do. Look, I mean, my biggest achievement as an amateur was winning the European bronze medal in Moscow in 2010. And that was like a monkey off my back, kind of, because you always remember the World's, Europeans and Olympics are the three majors, you know. And if you get a medal at any of them, like, you're in the history books, kind of, you know. And I was one of five medal winners for Team Ireland. We sent nine boxers. We won a gold, a silver, and three bronze. And we finished second in the medals table to Russia in a European championships. 50-something countries. Like, we won the RT Sports Team of the Year that year, beating... do you remember Tipperary stopped Kilkenny doing the... Tipperary were even nominated too. We beat them for the Team of the Year. Because, like, think about it, little old Ireland was ahead of Ukraine, Great Britain, Germany, France, Italy. We were ahead of them in the medal table. It's incredible. It's one of the greatest Irish team performances. Yeah. Like, you know,
think of all the great boxing nations that would be in that, you know?
Huge.
Unbelievable. Yeah. But will we go back to the back, or back to the start?
Yeah, work away.
For the people that aren't into boxing, who are you and where are you from?
Well, my name is Eric Donovan. I'm from Athy in County Kildare. Go by the kind of stage moniker, professional boxing name is the Lily White Lightning, you know, which I'm very proud of. But I'm based in Drogheda at the moment. I live in Drogheda, County Loud. But as you know, I'm a reigning Irish featherweight boxing champion, represented Ireland for over 10 years as an amateur.
Very proud.
And very, very proud. Yeah, had a great career. Achieved an awful lot, but probably could have achieved a lot more. But I was dealing with a lot of deep emotional, mental health problems throughout my career. And I was living a secret life for a long time. When I say secret, it probably wasn't secret. You know what I mean? We think people in addiction think they're living a secret, but everybody knows, you know. But I would have been in active addiction for a very long time, probably for most of the duration of my amateur career.
What about when you were in school as well?
And in school, right through from the age of 13, 14, right up to 26,
It must be. Like, there's not many people can go on and have a career like you in boxing and also be addicted to alcohol or drugs at the same time. Like, that must have took up every single bit of energy you had in your life.
Oh, huge. It was just so, like, demanding, so, what would you say, exhausting as well, you know, because you're... One minute you're up with the high performance team from Tuesday to Friday and you're surrounded by the best professional kind of setup, best conditions, physios, doctors, nutritionists, the best coaches, the best facilities. And then you go home on a Friday and you're just searching for oblivion, escaping from reality. Yeah. And you're home then Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. And then you're back up in Dublin with the team again and you're burning the candle at both ends, you know. Yeah. Mm. But because I was so young, we have this innate ability when you're young to kind of, you know, shake off the damage of the weekend or whatever. And you kind of, you get, not that you're getting away with it, but you can kind of
push
keep
it, brush
going,
it off
keep
bit,
going. Yeah, you can keep going. But I never got the chance to because there was times where I'd go here and then I'd come back and here and back and never really pushed on.
What was school like for you?
School?
Yeah.
Well, to be honest, school was very poor. Like, for me, I had a really poor education. Poor in the sense that, like, I never felt adequate or never felt capable while I was in school. Mm-hmm. And I think that's maybe due to my own mum and dad. They left school when they were young as well. You know, they got married very young.
Old school.
There was no real emphasis. Get out the door and go to school. But there was no real supports, you know. Mm-hmm. Sit down with you, work with you. You know, for some families, like, you know, even
that
back
is
then,
reality, isn't it?
Yeah, even back then, the main job or the main focus might be to get from one end of the week to the next, and one end of the day to the next. You know, not to sit down and go through books and, you know, lectures and stuff like that. So, you know, I turned up, you know, and but never really excelled. You know,
was
never
the sports more your thing.
Yeah, sports most of my thing now. Even like I would have felt anxious in school a lot, you know, like today I'm going to be exposed today or whatever. And I kind of navigated around that, always trying to avoid being caught in the headlights, you know, trying to get away with being in the spotlight, you know, kind of felt like it did the opposite of what it was supposed to do. Instead of feeling educated and developed, I felt inadequate and I regressed, you know? And then when I discovered that you could sit up on top of a tree in a park and be at peace with yourself, as opposed to sitting down behind a desk feeling inadequate, the route I took, you know? So,
You know, if you were to describe Eric Donovan as a child, what kind of a disposition would you say? Or what kind of personality? Were you introverted, quiet and shy? Or Were you kind of like a boy's boy, just wanting to be involved in sport?
I'd say I was a very gullible, influential young kid. Very influenced by other people. Always trying to fit in, you know, with the rest of the
easily led. Gang.
Yeah, oh, completely. You know, you told me to jump, I'd say how high, you know. Always young, mischievous as well, rebellious young kid. My mom and dad separated when I was only a baby as well. So, like, that must have been tough. When I say that, like, I didn't have my dad growing up. Like, I was only, like, 6 months old or something when they separated. But I'd say for my mom, who was probably 25 at that time with 4 young kids, probably all under the age of 10, must have been very difficult. But I didn't know as a young kid, you know. And then a couple of years after, I had a stepdad come in, and then I have 2 younger sisters. So we're 6, you know. And then stepdad, my mom and my stepdad, they're still together and all. But I can imagine it must have been very difficult, because I'm a father now, you know, and I have 2 boys. And I know how difficult it is to be a dad, you know what I mean? So I can imagine the mid-1980s, around that, you know, 25 years of age, you're married, you know, mom and dad were married, and next they're separated, and that must have been very tough, you know?
Yeah, because you can put yourself in your kids' shoes now, and if you left their house now, it must be very difficult, and I can relate as well.
You see, it's only when you start having kids and you start going through life yourself and challenges that you can actually think back to what it was like for before, and you can understand and you have more compassion for the people that was in your life, you know. And I've heard many of your stories and with your guests and everything. Instead of, like, you know, feeling like angry or hurt towards other people, you're more compassionate about the difficulty that they had going up and what they've provided you with and stuff like that, you know, and the chances that they gave you, you know what I mean? Like, I'm very lucky.
That's what recovery gives you as well, Eric. It gives you that awareness around how it might have been for maybe your mother or father, and how they may have struggled as well, you know. But when somebody goes into recovery and they start getting help for whatever difficulties they may have, they start to grow, and the compassion then starts to come when they start looking back at their own parents' situations when they were young, and that's a great thing to have, is to be able to have some empathy.
Yeah, it is. Empathy is probably the number one, you know. And and, like, even growing up, we didn't have a lot. Like, we didn't have anything at all, like, you know, but we had a love for each other, you know what I mean? There was a great love and a great bond for each other, you know. And there's a great closeness, and I often find today that a lot of my qualities that I have come from my mother, you know. Just that, you know, the love and genuine qualities, you know what I mean? And they serve you well in life, you know. You don't pick up them in a classroom, like, you know what I mean? But they're just, like, you know.
Sure, makes you who you are.
They're just qualities to help you kind of connect with people and move on, you know, and that kind of stuff.
So when you started experimenting then in secondary school, want to tell us a little bit about that, how you kind of got caught up in it and how it escalated?
It's weird because, like, you know, I started smoking probably the age of 12 or something like that. And I can't even remember how it transpired, but I do remember trying it for the first time, and I was in a backfield and it left me green on cigarette, like, you know, green on my stomach, twisting and turning and sick. But undeterred, you know, kept going back for more, you know, really glutton for punishment, like, you know. And I remember taking my first drink of wine as well, and that left me sick. Wine was my first, first taste of alcohol. Wine, talk about top shelf, like, you know. And
the rest of us were drinking cider.
Yeah, and, like, the thing was, like, it just made me very, very ill, but I kept going back to it, like, for some reason, you know. But then it wasn't long before you start kind of getting the comfort for it, and the kind of, you know,
the tolerance for it,
you know, you build up the tolerance for it, and then you kind of feel like you need it for everything. You need it for walking to school, you need it for walking out of school, you need it for lunch, you need a cigarette for everything, you know. Becomes a source. It's like in the Irish culture, we need a drink for fun, a drink to enjoyment, you know. That's where it was, and everything associated on a fag and a drink, and then it went to hash. And then it kind of progressed, like, from that, you know what I mean? But
was it causing conflict for your home? Or were you able to hide it?
I know, sure. Like, it was, like, sure. My older brothers as well, like, they would have dabbled in it as well, like, you know what I mean? And my mom would have had her work cut out, like, you know. And sure, I often think back, like, you know, she really would, like, we would have taken her toll on her, like, you know what I mean? She just couldn't handle us, like, you know, young lads, you know what I mean? Here, there, everywhere, gone, just see, you know, we're talking earlier about being secrets and everything. Like, sure, I used to be locked in my room, I'd climb out to the bathroom window and down the pipe, you know, just like Fireman Sam, you know what I mean? 13, 14, you know, get in, you're not going out, bam, okay, out to the window, down the pipe. You'd have been gone, just lethal, you can never hold me down, you know what I mean? Yeah. And, just so much energy. But boxing is where I, you know, like boxing was where I was able to generate that energy into somewhere constructive.
Can you remember the first time you went into a boxing gym?
Oh yeah.
Do you want to tell
never
us
forget
about,
it like
do you want to tell us a little bit about
to be
that?
Honest, I was only talking about this today in a school, right? I wanted to go down to the boxing club. It was in an old nun's hall outside the estate that I grew up in. And my two older brothers were in it. I wanted to go down with them, you know. And my mother was like, no, you're not going down. It's too rough and you're too young, you know. I was only seven, you know. But again, you know, I do, you know, go against the grain, ran down anyway, walked into the door and I'll never forget it. Just the noise. I was struck by the noise, the smell, the atmosphere, the ropes, you know what I mean? And the bags, pa, pa, pa. And I was just like, wow, this is cool. Like, this is cool, you know? Boys sweating and, you know, just, there's a real kind of a, I don't know, the testosterone started to come out, you know?
What age are we talking here?
Seven.
Are we talking like Michael Cruz time?
Oh, right, yeah. So I was 92.
That's around that, because we're the same age, like, so I'm thinking Michael Crude around that time. Yeah.
That's right, yeah. And I remember him being on the pictures all around the garages and all, jumping up, like, you know, I think it was the Esso or the Maxall or did some sort of a sponsorship thing with him when he was around all them. But, yeah, so seven, and, you know, I remember actually, like, I started swinging out of bags before I was punching him, like, literally jumping up wrapped around. And Dom is my coach, and I like, Dom is an incredible man, like, you know, he's the president of the Irish Amateur Boxing Association today, and he would be dealing with most of the biggest decisions in Irish boxing at central council level.
Yeah,
but on any given night you could see him down in the club in a tie holding up the mitts for a young kid, you know, giving him a chance. And what he didn't do for me is not even worth talking about, boys. It's like, I wouldn't be probably here today if he didn't pursue me, because I left boxing more times. I got, like, when I started to discover the girls and the cigarettes and the drink, I didn't want to run anymore or box anymore or lose weight anymore, you know. Go away. Dom used to call to my house, like, you know, I'd be disconnecting from the club. This is around 14, 15. He said, what's going on with you? I haven't seen you for weeks or something. And I said, Dom, I gave enough of my life to box now. 14 or 15. You know, I've enough now. I've done enough. I've won enough. And I've been multiple Irish champion. This is where I was breaking onto the Irish team and everything. I was being offered captaincy roles and everything, you know, representing Ireland. But I didn't want to go. I wanted to be with the lads. Fear of missing out. Fear of missing out on what? Hanging around the alley, smoking and drinking, like doing absolutely nothing.
But that's so common, Eric. Yeah. That's so common. Like, when we've often spoke about some of the young lads that are from our area.
Plenty of boxers as well.
And boxers that have went across to England, you know.
Would have boxed for Ireland at times as well, you know. And
the drink and the drugs come in. And it takes them away from it. Even myself, when I used to play soccer when I was young, 14, 15, had the drink, gave me the self-esteem and the confidence to talk to the women, something that I didn't have without a drink.
Yeah.
You know, it's just so common for that's the age, isn't it? 13, 14,
critical
15.
Years, the 14s and 15s, you know, especially when they start dropping out of sport, you're in trouble, you know. So you're lucky you had that man that, you know, he perceived, he was really hell-bent on keeping you on the straight and narrow. Do you know, when you started the boxing, did you find that you had a flair for it very quickly?
Oh man, just took to it like a duck to water, like, you know, slipping, rolling, ducking, diving. I honestly, and I've no problem saying this, boxing was easy for me. I could express myself in the ring. I was just southpaw, light on my feet, elusive, slick, making lads miss, destroying lads, beating them 10-0, 15-0, all this, like, all the way up along, winning multiple Irish championships. Like, there's lads used to kind of jump up or jump down in the weights to avoid me, like, you know what I mean? Yeah. And stuff like that. And, you know, when you're younger, that can it can kind of feed your ego and you kind of think that, okay, I have this, I'm always going to be like this. But talent only gets you so far. Then when you get to a certain age, you have to work hard. And I mean work hard, because the lad might not have any talent or he might not have a fraction of your talent, but he's in the gym every night and he's training and he's sacrificing. And when he gets you, then, you know what I mean, then your talent's not enough, because this guy is resilient and he's going. And that's what happened to me. I got found out a couple of times, you know what I mean? But then I realized I had to work hard as well. But I did. I worked hard. And it's incredible that I've even achieved what I've achieved, you know, dealing with the kind of...
Yeah, how did you manage to, like, you were taking drugs and drinking and stuff, but you were still fighting in the gym. Did you look back on your amateur career and think, like, imagine I wasn't drinking and taking drugs, what I could have done? Or, do you look back on your amateur career and think, no, I did pretty well there?
I had this ridiculous tear. Like, I often do look back. I look back with the two of those kind of viewpoints. Like, yeah, I did well considering, but I could have done this and that, you know, but... I had this mad kind of a theory. Say if I lost a fight and I did like, I was taking, say I was drinking and drugging and everything up on to about 6 weeks before the competition. And that's what it would be like. I would normally be like 6 weeks and I'd kind of go white knuckle it and go into straight and narrow, you know what I mean? And be just complete stubborn and get 3 weeks of good or 6 weeks of good living and clean living and hard work and hard training. And then if I lost or lost hard, I'd say, Jesus, I lost only by 2 points, but I only did 6 weeks and I was doing it. So if I did 8 weeks, you know what I mean? And I'd be saying this kind of stuff to myself. It's ridiculous what I was doing. Like, not considered giving it up all, not considering you need help. You're going into box, you know, in an Irish championship against the best in the country and you're smoking and drinking and you're, you know, and even smoking, I was always smoking, always smoking. I never was able to give up the fags. And that's one of the greatest things ever now, to be free from cigarettes. Like, just to be, I'm in complete recovery now.
Yeah.
And I get my kicks out of just life itself. My son, my two sons, my fiance, and life and friends and you know, doing things, working and, you know, and that to me there is a miracle.
It's a beautiful place
to
be.
That's a miracle because I'm kind of like, man, I spent a lot of money to try and feel this feeling. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which is not even, it wouldn't even be a close feeling. It's an artificial feeling you're getting, do you know?
Do you know what it sounds like? It sounds like, say if you go up Corran Tool, up some beautiful mountain or go on some beautiful walk and you get to the top of the mountain and you can't appreciate it because you're caught up in your head because you're addicted or whatever. But when you go into recovery, all that stuff changes. You can actually appreciate life and beauty and walks and nature for actually what it is. So they're the things that the recovery process does give people afterwards. It gives them that appreciation for nature and beautiful things, you know. So
second chance to me.
That's it.
It's a second chance. It's honestly, that's what it's like. We get a second roll of the dice, you know. And many people probably can't, people who are not in recovery or who have no experience of addiction can't relate to that. They get one shot at it and it's the same for them. But we get a second shot, a different shot, a chance to go a different way, a different route. And then it is more beautiful. It's a real kind of a, you feel like you've earned it, you know, in a way, because it's special because you have earned it. It wasn't handed to you. You worked for it. And you know, you remember the pain of the past. You know what it was like, the roughness. Like I had my stag 2 weeks ago, 20 lads got down in Galway, great crack. A couple of sober lads on it, but other lads had a, you know, good few drinks. And I used to have this fear of my stag or my future wedding. I'd say I can't have a wedding or can't have a stag because my life's over. Because I give up the drink. Do you know what I mean?
I know.
But like, you know, I had a brilliant time. And great conversations and great company and the next day, waking up the next day and driving down the road and went to Salt Hill. It was in Galway and then went to Salt Hill about 10 minutes from where he's dead and jumped in off the bear straight into the into the sea. Just deadly. You know what I mean?
It's great. And then, but you can have some crack in recovery. Like, you know, people do think that, oh, I can't drink no more, especially my life is over. But do you want to tell us a little bit about after 14, 15, how you rode out that period in your life and like how the drinking and stuff progressed then later into your later teens?
Yeah, it's mental. It kind of progressed very quick. You know, when you grow up, like, you know, like, you know, when you're growing up in like council estates, like in places like that, you know, would have been deemed like disadvantaged area where I grew up in, you know what I mean? And I remember one of the older boys, well, he wasn't too much older. He was 15, I was 14, and a good few of us were kind of around that age bracket, 14, 15, 16. we're all drinking, we're all smoking weed. And that's the thing, why I never felt it was outrageous what I was doing. Growing up, everyone was doing it.
Yeah, why not?
So, you know, you kind of feel like, if this is my community, I don't know what's going on in other communities, but this is mine, and this is what they're all doing, so it must be fine, you know?
Yeah.
But we knew ecstasy was on the go,
yeah.
You know, but it was the 17 and 18 year olds that were doing it, you know what I mean? And the older ones that were doing it, like, and we aspired to be like them one day, you know? But when one of my close mates, 15, took one, we all heard about it, and he was telling us all the next day, and like, he's standing in the state, right?
He's not dead.
And we're all, no, he's not dead.
Yeah.
He's buzzing, and we're all standing in a circle around him, like that, looking up at him, right? Because he's tall as well, and he's like, lads, the best. Lads are not messy. Tell us this. And we're all just like, roll on the weekend.
Yeah.
Because he done it and he's still alive. You know, and then we done it. And then it was just like a weekend thing. You know what I mean? Yeah. Just like the more, you know, wasn't just one then. It was, you know, a couple or a handful. And just, it was constant. Then, you know, later on then, I think it was maybe 18 or 19, maybe then when cocaine kind of came on the scene. And then that was a more kind of a, seen as an upper class kind of a drug, you know, it costs more money and everything like that. But
different drug as well, isn't it? There's different
things. Type of drug as well. You'd kind of be able to, you'd be able to kind of,
it's
doctor, doesn't knock you for six in a way. You can kind of socialize and do that kind of stuff.
Yeah. But the ecstasy definitely was a different kind of level of stuff. There'd be a lot of love with the ecstasy, and
a lot of crack
and you'd be friends. No, the reason we do talk about this is because, like, you know, every teenager, most teenagers come from areas like where we come from. They all try it. Mm. Some kids
try
use it a little bit more than others, you know. Mm. But for me, anyway, on my own level, like, first time I tried an ecstasy tablet, it was like, oh god.
So it's great crack. It's great crack, but after a couple of years of it, or after not, it does get very, it
dims your brain, man. You're tripping, and when you're there, you're drinking a night, you're drinking a hell of a lot as well, you're smoking a hell of a lot, you're up for hours, you're up for days, you know, and you're just, you think you're coming down off your buzz, and you're not, and you take another one, and you'll be taking another one, you know, and you don't want to, it's the never ending weekend, you know, and that goes on, and it does, it takes its toll on you, you know what I mean? And your phone is off, and your family's looking for you, and everybody's going mad, where are you? You know, my coach pulled me out of house parties before. Would you believe that?
Okay.
Pulled me out of house parties. pulled me out of house party one time and brought me to Mullingar to fight in an open air show. I'll never forget it. I fought this guy called David Nevin. And, oh, jeez, we tore lumps out of each other in the ring. Because, like, I promised him I'd go, you know. So he was, and he promised another coach he'd have me there for his boxer. He pulled me out of a house party. Got me, you know, come on, you have to go. You can sleep in the car, he goes, you know. How could I sleep in the car? I was wide awake, you know. And I got to Mullingar anyway, in the mid open air show. I had a fight with your man, and you know, I think it was an exhibition anyway, but got out of the ring, and I didn't even get a chance to get on my boots or my shorts or anything. I was sitting in the chair outside, and I knocked out. I fell asleep. They had to wake me up a few hours later.
When the cocaine enters your life, then were you working at that stage?
Yeah, well, I never was really working. I was kind of like, you know, I was on the high performance team in Dublin as from 17 years of age. By the age of 17, like, I was actually, I have a piece of history there. I'm the youngest ever Four Nations senior champion. So that's the senior champion of England, Ireland, Scotland and Wales while I was 17. I was only a junior and I was Four Nations senior champion. So you can't, there was a time when you were a junior, you're allowed to enter the seniors.
Mm.
Not anymore. You have to be 18 or 19
now. So that record won't be beaten.
So it can't be, no. But I was the champion of England, Ireland, Scotland, Wales as a junior. I was the Four Nations senior champion. So that's why I got kind of selected and invited up to the high performance team. And there was big things laid out for me around that time, you know.
What's it like being selected, and what's it like going up there?
Yeah, it's huge. Because one time, like, there were stages up there, like, where I was... you know, aspirations and dreams to be the best, like, you know, to be the absolute best. And I knew, I'm a smart enough guy as well. I knew as well what I was doing in my social life was wrong, but also didn't know how to get out of it.
Yeah.
Because, like, how do you go? How do you go and say to somebody, like, look, I'm in trouble here. I need help. Like, that's a weakness. You know, we all try to cover it. Yeah. Ah, yeah, I'm grand. Everything's good. You know, and I remember the likes of, like, Gary Keegan and Billy Walsh and the head coaches and my own coach, Tom O'Rourke, and all that would have a lot of times kind of, you know, came face to face with me, you know, and, are you all right? Like, and stuff. Yeah, grand, no worries. You know, I'm all good. But you wouldn't be good, you know? You wouldn't be good, and you wouldn't know how to kind of, how to put up your hands and say, I'm in trouble here. I need help. I need intervention.
Yeah.
You know, you can't make your own intervention, you know, unfortunately. You wish you could, but...
some people look at 18, 19-year-old, 20-year-olds that take drugs like that, and they think, like, or is it hedonistic, you know, they're on the out for themselves and they don't want any responsibility. But I can totally identify with you there. 18, 19, I wanted out. I just didn't know how to get out of it. I just thought that this was my life, this is what my peers was doing, and that's all that I could ever be. And I didn't really, even though I hated it and I was fed up of it, and the mental health was very poor and there was a lot of consequences coming because of it, I never really thought that there was another way, you know? So it's not that, like you can have that little bit of maturity even when you're so young. But I suppose when you're in the high performance unit and, you know, you're an elite boxer, you're going to come up against fellas that's your level of boxing, but they're not taking on drinking drugs, you know?
There you go.
You know?
Yeah. And the other thing as well is, like, some people, like, I grew up with, like, were able to kind of party at the weekends, but it didn't affect their lives, like, because they were able to leave it there at the weekends. I wasn't able to, because, and even when cocaine became a thing then as well, I became very greedy, you know what I mean? Like, I needed it, you know what I mean? I needed it to get through. And
yeah.
Like, that's the thing, like, I had a huge fear as well of how people would see me, or your rejection and fear of, you know, for all that kind of stuff. So that's why you wouldn't reach out and ask for help, you know. But
I suppose if you need people that you can look at that will inspire you as well, that are maybe on the recovery path as well. But if you don't have anybody in your circle that's actually in recovery and can spot that, you know, there's no real chance.
That was the game changer for me. You know, when I went in early 2012, I was at the jump off point. Like, I couldn't take anymore. I wanted to take my own life, like, you know, genuinely.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't want to die, but I didn't know how to live.
Yeah.
Imagine.
Yeah.
Put me in the ring with Olympic, world, European champions, and I'm at home. I'm at peace. It's outside the ring that I couldn't put one foot in front of the next. You know, it's crazy, isn't it? Like, I couldn't navigate my way through life. But in the ring is where I was at home. But you can't live in the ring either, you know? You have to get out in life. But when I went into rehabilitation early 2012, it was a game changer for me. Because I went from, in the space of a few weeks, a prime candidate for the London Olympic Games, to wanting to take my own life, to now suddenly sitting in a rehabilitation centre surrounded by a load of people that I never met before in my life, you know what I mean? And you might look at that and think that's very bleak, you know, and a very kind of a sadness to that. And there is, in a way, right? But there's also a lot of hope in it. Because I went from in that place, like, I was trying to make sense of my life there, but that's the key word. I was trying to make sense. The key word, I suppose, is, sorry, I was trying to understand my life in there, and that was the key word, understand. And in there, I was surrounded by people who could help me to understand, experts, therapists, counsellors, and other people who walked in my shoes.
Where did you go?
Asheree in Wexford.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And what age did you say you were?
I was, 2012, going on, 2012. I was going on 20, I was 25 heading on 26, yeah. And, you know, and then I started to realise why I was doing the things I was doing. Why I was failing, why I was messing up, why I was self-destructing. And then I started to understand that there's more therapeutic and holistic strategies and tools to use than the ones I've been using.
Yeah.
And then that was it. And you talk about seeing other people, you know, because all I seen was the opposite.
Yeah.
This is how you get, you know, this is how you self-destruct. No, didn't, you know, have the other side of it. This is how you look after yourself.
Yeah.
Then when I started kind of engaging with them people and moving towards those people, there was a different way.
I can relate a lot with you there, because we're the same age. So when you're talking about the eras of your life, I'm thinking of what I was doing at that time. But I remember watching Katie Taylor win the Olympic gold medal in the London Olympics. Was strung out of my head that time, and heroin and tablets. But I was in treatment the following summer. In 2013, but I think 25, 26, it's a good age for a fella to get it, because you're getting a bit mature. You know, there's been a few treatment centres I'd been in before that, but I didn't really have the maturity or the belief. But like that, I began to learn, like, different coping skills, like basic life skills, filling in applications, how to look after yourself. I couldn't really cope. And you know, you learn that in a treatment centre, and it doesn't matter what treatment centre really. When you're ready, they'll all work, you know. And
of course, and you see, I know you're going back into education. I think you are as well, Teddy. Yeah. You weren't ready in the earlier part of your life. You weren't equipped to deal with the education system at that time. You didn't have the supports either to help you. I was the same. If I had to base myself on the today, with the viewpoint of my previous education, primary and secondary, I would have a very dim view of myself. You know what I mean? I'd feel absolutely useless. But I was 27 when I went back into third level education as well. I'm a student counsellor, psychotherapist now. So I have a diploma, I have 2-year full-time diploma in counselling psychotherapy, and I've 1 year left to do my degree.
Brilliant.
But I just put that off because I turned professional in 2016 and said I want to roll the dice one more time in my professional career because I felt like all my amateur career I was in active addiction. And even though I achieved a lot, I did all of that while being under that kind of duress and dysfunction and this, you know, just complete madness, like, and the shackles as well of addiction. Mm. And then, you know, suddenly I have them off. I'm free and I have this new mindset. I'm still young. I have a lot of experience. I'm healthy and I have a foundation of an education to fall back on. That's when I decided, like, I came to the conclusion I can always go back and do my degree.
Exactly.
But I can't always go back and box. Yeah. And I turned pro in 2016 and at the moment, like, I'm 14-1 and I'm closing in on a European title shot. So
how long were you out of boxing?
I was about 3 years, 2013 to 16. Yeah. So I was keeping active and sparring. I'd help out my coach, you know, I'd go down and spar them, and I was in recovery as well. So I'd go down and he would say, geez, you have it, you haven't lost it, you know? Yeah. And, you know, and then I started to kind of feel good about myself, you know? And I said, Jesus, you know, if I actually put a bit of work in now, I wonder what I could, you know what I mean? Because it's about smart training and a lot of it is up here though, to be honest with you, you know? If you're getting yourself fairly well, but a lot of it is up there, you know? And
What's the big difference, or what's the difference as you see it, fighting amateur to professional?
Oh, it's a big difference. It's the amateur game is a more kind of a stylish, skillful game. And the professional game, even though it has that kind of skill and all that element to it, there's another element to it, and it's a more vicious, barbaric element, you know. And I think, you know, when you saw me on Sky Sports that time against Alpha Barrett, where I was boxing the head off him for 6 rounds, and then I got absolutely walked onto a haymaker in the seventh.
The same to Dillian White the same night.
His was the week after mine. Week after, I was kind of glad because mine was the knockout of the year until that happened.
That's
I was like, thank God. He gave Dillian White some uppercut, wasn't it?
That's right.
Eddie Hearn's backyard, and you know, but even taking that, right, I was offered the fight against Alpha Baird, step up weight, come in and fight him after 3 years in retirement, and you know, going against this hot shot, you know. I took that fight, trained hard for it, gave a good account of myself, came up short ultimately, but walked away as a winner. Now, when I say that, like, people say, like, I'm not saying that in a kind of like a winner in the sense of like I won the match. No, a winner in the sense that I felt very good about myself. Mm-hmm. I felt very proud. Yeah. And because before, when I was in my amateur days and I was in addiction, the outcome of a boxing match would determine my whole health and well-being. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, literally, it became my whole identity, boxing, at a stage. And it was just it was giving me the last bit of integrity that I had. And it was terrible because I'm more than a boxer, you know. Mm. But I walked away from that fight knowing that, you know, I just had this really good feeling about myself and everything's going to be all right, you know. I got in there on the big stage, dished it out, got knocked out, got up, carried on. But, you know, eventually he finished me. But I got out of ropes that night not feeling like a loser. Does that make sense?
Well, when you think about where you've come from, you know, the headspace you're in, you know, to be in treatment back at square one with it all to do, to work, put in the hours and the work and to get yourself into that position to be fighting, you know, somebody on that stage is unbelievable.
The addicted ego was gone out of you as well.
Yeah.
And you have more acceptance and surrender around your life and how things are, and to be able to know that you didn't done everything you could and fight like that.
I was able to cry naturally.
Yeah.
I cried because I was hurt, because I put a lot into it, and I was sad because I lost.
Yeah.
But then I picked myself up and moved on. But that was, and that's how it should be.
Yeah.
But where before, when I lost in the amateur, I remember losing a big fight in the amateurs. I didn't cry. And I went home and I took a lot of cocaine. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah, that's
it. I know.
And that's how I, you know, kind of consoled myself.
Or, crying is a healthy coping skill to have.
Oh, it's brilliant. I loved it. Not that I loved it, but yeah. I enjoyed that kind of, that I was able to do that.
You don't
it
need
meant
a
so much to me, I cried. Yeah,
you don't need a substance to deal with emotion, you know?
No.
And
pure, raw and honest.
It's tough for men to be like that, like, but it's a good place to be. But it takes a lot of work, it takes a lot of personal development. And, to, you know, as Timmy said around self-acceptance, you know what? I fucking, I give up my all and I'm actually content with that. It didn't work out, but I'll be back again, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and but I do genuinely.
You're far from done.
I do genuinely believe I'll be back again. I was so unfortunate back in May. I worked my way into a European title shot.
That's right.
And 10 days before I was due to go out to Italy to fight Mario Alfano for the EU European Super Featherweight title in Lombardy in Italy, live on Italian television and everything. 10 days beforehand, my last sparring session, my last spar, I fractured my ribs.
Oh, shit. Yeah. Did you spar that roughly?
I sparred two guys and they were getting in one the next. And it was a conditioning strategy. You know what I mean? I was doing 10, they were doing 5 each, but I was doing 10 straight. And I just got clipped with a big wild kind of a punch right behind the elbow, done me, rested it for a few days, gave it every chance, came back after a couple of days rest, I couldn't even hit the pads. I was in that much pain.
Yeah.
And Packy said to me, he says, Eric, look, you can't get into a 12-round fight, which could potentially be a dog fight, if you can't even hit the pads. You know what I mean? And we had to postpone it. Like, so look, it's not dead in the water, but I hope to get myself back into that position early next year.
Yeah.
And that would be the icing on the cake for me, to come back and be European champion after all of that. That's what I hold on to. That's the
Who's the last European champion we've had?
We've a couple now. We've Tommy McCarthy from Belfast. Well, he's just lost it actually there recently to Chris Billam Smith. But Tommy McCarthy's European champion. We had Bernard Dunn has obviously won the European title. Carl Frampton has won the European title.
Yeah.
We've
got some good boxers around at the moment too, don't we?
We have, yeah. Jason Quigley has after been announced to fight Bubu Andrade for the world title on November 20th. So I'm very good friends with Jason, you know, and his coach Andy Lee, we'd be very good friends as well. So I'm delighted for them.
Yeah.
And I'd love to see them come and do it, like, you know.
It's a
big
amazing
opportunity for him, like, you know.
Yeah. Bubu Andrade.
Yeah, anything can happen, but your man is good. But Jason's good too, you know. Just need to perform, and we know we can perform on the big stage, you know.
Who's the elite in your weight class?
So I'm kind of between featherweight and super featherweight. So you're looking at Michael Conlan, John O'Carroll, all very good, serious boxers. TJ Doheny, former world title holder. He was in the super bantamweight.
What about that world level? Who's the belt holders at the
moment? Yeah, so you've got the super featherweights, then you've got Oscar Valdez, you've got, what's your man's name? Leo Santa Cruz. He's the guy that Frampton beat. Remember that? Yeah. You've got Gary Russell Jr. You've got those type of guys, Americans, Latinos, you know, they're the kind of guys that are holding the belts in the weight division. Lee Wood is the featherweight champion that just won it from. He's from Nottingham. He won it recently, and I think he's going to defend it against Michael Conlan. So that's going to be a huge fight, you know.
If you had three wishes, or if you had one wish, you could fight anybody at the moment. Would you like to select one? And I respect you if you don't want to say any names, because it was not to call somebody out, but if you had a dream fight, like, would you like to fight Michael Conlan on a big fucking Croke Park event, or would you like a shot at a title?
I tell you what, some people have said this to me. There's no particular names that I'd like to fight, but I would love to be involved in a classic. Like, I sometimes think about the fight against Alpha Barrett. Like, I was doing so well and beating him, and then he knocked me down. And then I got up and he knocked me down again, and I got up and I survived to the rest of the round. And then the next round I was thinking, I'm going to get back in this fight.
Yeah.
I'm going to get myself back. But I was still concussed, right? You think in your head, you think you're grand, but I was still concussed. And then he caught me again, and the referee said no. I was getting back up to fight, but the referee said no. And look, he's right. You know what I mean? You have to protect the boxer as well.
Yeah.
But I would have loved to be involved in, like, I would have loved to see out that fight. Do you know what I mean? On my feet.
Yeah.
And maybe even, like, if I came back and won it, because I was a mile ahead and I didn't realize it at the time, but I probably could have even taken a round off. I was so far ahead. And when I look at the fights of the past, the classic fights, like Bernard Dunn's world title fight was incredible. He got knocked down a few times. He knocked your man down.
Mm.
And then, you know, one stage he looked like he was gone, like he was over, and then he'd get up and then he'd knock your man down and win the title. I love those dramatic fights. Yeah. So there's nobody I kind of have kind of earmarked or that to kind of
It's just fight. More the occasion just, than the night.
But I would really love, my goal is to, well, I have two. Win the European title and defend it in Kildare. That's the two dreams I have.
Nice.
And
might get Christy Moore to sing you into the ring.
And wouldn't that be incredible? Yeah. The Curra of Kildare. Huh? Yeah, it'd be deadly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, but no, like all the boys, like I think them Irish boys, like, you know, John O'Carroll, Michael Connell, Jason Quigley and all them boys, like they're all doing really well, like, you know, and they're all world title contenders. I'm just happy to get a European where I am. If I got a European, I'd be hang up the gloves and be content.
That's very achievable,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah.
We'll take you away from boxing there for a minute. Right. Do you know, doing that degree that you're doing in psychotherapy and counselling, I'm looking at you here and I'm listening to you and I'm seeing recovery and you were talking about your own story growing up and nobody really being there that you could talk to about what was going on for you. Can you see yourself maybe going into a role in that within Irish sports for some of our elite athletes, maybe?
I do a school speaking circuit. I do speak to, I do corporate talks. I do sports teams. And I speak about performance. I speak about like health and well-being. And I'm very passionate about the area of health and well-being, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it's a big problem at the moment. Like, you know, and I was speaking in a school today at the Christian Brothers College today. I was speaking to a lot of students over there and I have a couple more talks there now tomorrow. And I always say to the students when I speak to them, before I share with them, I always say, lads, I wish I had somebody come in and share with me what I'm going to share with you when I was at school. And I didn't have that luxury, you know. But the amount of people, there hasn't been a talk that I've done that where someone hasn't reached out to me afterwards and said, thank you. You've really helped me there. And that's why I do it.
Yeah.
There's always somebody suffering in silence because I would have been that person.
Yeah.
And I would have used other coping mechanisms to kind of play the kind of big man that I'm grand, you know, and, you know, sure, I'm grand, not a bother on me, you know. But like deep down, you know, really, I was struggling, you know.
I think it's great with someone with your profile in boxing.
Yeah.
And, you know, to be able to come out and talk about the mental health and the addiction side of it and now be going on to be a psychotherapist and going down that route. Like, there's a lot of people going to benefit from your story and your knowledge in psychotherapy and counselling, you know. So
yeah,
I just want to commend you on that.
Thanks. No, thanks to me. And I honestly, like, I'm a great admirer of your work and your work, James, and I think the guests that you have on here is brilliant. Yeah. Like, and these are the real impactful human interaction kind of conversations and stories that we need to have. And I just think I'm gone complete 360 now because I wouldn't tell anyone the truth in my life. You know, I was kind of like a bit of a liar and a bit of a, you know, couldn't what someone say to me, couldn't lie straight in the bed. You know what I mean? but now I'm gone the complete opposite, you know, and I love that human and just that real human connection with people, you know, honestly, real talk, like, you know what I mean? And without kind of screaming it from the rooftops, but like, it's really lovely to sit down and just have a cup of tea or a cup of coffee and have a good, honest chat with somebody. And I've had so many of them. And even if I'm helping somebody, I'm helping myself. I come away as well with just as much out of it as sitting with somebody who's awful, you know what I mean?
I always say like that through the lockdown when we started this, like, this is weekly therapy for me. I don't know about Timmy, but every week I get out of my house, I get to meet interesting people and talk about recovery most of the time, and it's an outlet for me.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a huge support I use, you know what I mean? And I love speaking with people like yourself, you know, because it's, you know, my wife is in recovery, I work in addiction services, the podcast is themed around recovery. My life is built in a way, structured in a way where it's very easy for me to maintain my recovery, you know?
Yeah.
And but there's people, like, before I was in recovery, before you were in recovery, you're at home and you're thinking, how am I going to get out of it? Is this what's all there for me? But when we share our stories, like, we're going to get emails now about you, you know?
Yeah.
Love listening to Eric. Where's Asha? You read, you know? What did he do afterwards, you know? and we're inspiring people, and you're inspiring people, yeah. and we share our stories, not for pats on the back, but because the people are going to be at home. Some people are going to be at home struggling, and they're going to identify with you, and then they're going to contact us or somebody and get the ball rolling, because it all starts with a spark, not planting the seeds.
It does. Like, life is tough. Anyways, in general, life is tough. It's a tough old slog, like, you know what I mean? Like, and when you haven't got the kind of resources or the kind of supports around you and all that, can be extremely tough. And then you wonder why drugs is so big, why drugs is such why is such a problem in society. You know what I mean? Because there's so many candidates for it.
Yeah.
People are broken. People are really, really struggling. Here you go. Here you go. You can have a bag of coke the size of, you know, a bag of crisps at your door if you want, and with a text message, like a Deliveroo.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Knock your door. But then if you want mental health service, join the queue.
I know.
You know, and if you've no private care, private healthcare,
forget about it.
Join the queue.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the problem.
I know.
You know?
And that queue, then you could easily die in that queue, like, while you're waiting in that queue. By your own hand or whatever else. No. You know, and that's the sad point of it. And people are really just shouting out.
Yeah.
And they're really, really struggling. And there should be more of an emphasis around that from our government, don't you think?
There should. Of course, you know, there should. I genuinely believe that. There has to be a lot more of, like I could talk about this stuff. I get all passionate. I do get really annoyed about this stuff. Like, say even the prison system. It's just it's a one-tier system for everybody. Like, there should be, like, at the first stages of, you know, say a crime, or, you know, there should be intervention where people can not go to prison, but go off and do a 6-month army course or something. Like, look at all the armies and all the soldiers in this country. I know a lot of them would love to actually be working with people, helping them to make a change.
Yeah.
You know, like this Health Week or this Hell Week thing that's on TV.
Yeah.
These are Rangers. Now, I know that's more extreme, but down at the lower level, the corporals and the privates and stuff like that, like, if they were even, like, educated enough to kind of take someone on a 6-month course of, you know, just like
discipline,
life skills, you know, values, you know, value system, help them to build making their own beds, this kind of stuff. Because some of these guys haven't had the greatest starts in life, right? Yeah. But where are they going? They're going into prison.
Yeah.
They're going straight into prison. And and just threw into a room.
Yeah, I know.
And threw in
it's just storing them for a short period of time until they get back.
That's 100 grand a year.
I know.
From one prison, you know.
It's unbelievable.
And I just think there's so many other, like, and anyway, that's why I travel around to schools and I talk, because when people think of me as a boxer, they think boxing, champion, tough, brave, you know, synonymous with being macho, and, you know, but I tried to say it to people, like, you know, I had to train as a boxer. And no matter what you train at, you can be good at, because that's a skill level, you know. But behind the boxing gloves, behind the head guard, behind your, say, a musician, behind the guitar, behind the football boots, behind whatever it is, you're a human being.
Yeah.
And we have emotions and feelings and thoughts. And if we don't work with them, if we don't, like, deal with them, they can be to the detriment of us, you know. So when people hear me saying that I felt sad or lonely or anxious at times, and now I ask for help when I feel like that, it gives them a bit of a, he can do it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He can do it, so can I. And that's why I do it.
Fair play. That's unbelievable. And you're absolutely right. It's when people see big profile peoples within our communities, or even in our communities, guys that would have had a reputation for being extremely violent and drug dealing and stuff, and then to actually stop, you know, and they say, listen, I'm struggling with my mental health, I have a drug problem or whatever else. It just kind of, as you said earlier, turns in the 360, and people say, you know what, I actually feel the same. You know, and it's actually okay to speak about it.
Yeah.
And then people start moving forward, and I look for services, and it works that way then.
Yeah.
You know, if people look at the Irish champion, you know, professional boxer, as, like, as you said, all these stereotypes, tough image, macho, but on any given day, we can struggle, and you know, we're a work in progress, we're only human at the end of the day, and we all have life's pressures, but we find coping skills through services that are available, and you're going into the services, and you're going to help a lot of people, one person at a time. You'll help them to repair their lives, I would say you're going to fix them, but that's probably not the right thing to say.
Yeah.
You facilitate them to help them fix themselves, I think is probably a better way of putting it. But
Educate them.
But best of luck with everything going forward. You're getting married soon.
Yeah, get married 3 weeks from today.
Brilliant.
You know, to Laura, my beautiful fiance.
It's congratulations, Laura.
Thank you. Yeah.
Congratulations.
It's our third attempt. Two false starts with COVID.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Yeah. Yeah. So third time lucky now, please God. But we were supposed to get married in Spain initially. And then Spain, July 2020. And then we postponed it to April 21 in Spain. And then that didn't go ahead either. So we had to give up on Spain altogether with no guarantee. So we're getting married back home, and we have the numbers, we're allowed and all that, so we're just delighted. Perfect. Now that there's no, you know, and I think 3 days before we get married, is all restrictions are lifted, you know.
Oh, brilliant.
So it'll be the bank holiday weekend, yeah, and it'll be almost kind of like the end of, well, I don't know if COVID's ever going to end, but we say it's the end of COVID COVID, lads, go mental.
People are carrying on and they're enjoying their lives again. We were at an event over the weekend and
it was boxing.
And there was, everybody was having fun.
Yeah.
Everybody was enjoying themselves. Yeah. There was no masks, you know, and it was great to see it.
Isn't it amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Great, like.
And that's what I love. Yeah. I'm able to laugh now from the heart and the belly laughs. And before that was artificial, you know, and I paid money for that artificial feelings, you know.
Yeah.
But just even the realization of that for anyone that's listened to this podcast, to just know this, that recovery is possible. And a life without drink and drugs and gambling and whatever ever it is that is weighing you down is possible. A life far greater than the life you're living. You know, isn't like we're testament to that.
Yeah.
And, you know, hold on to that hope, people, you know, because without hope, you've not.
Just take that first step, whatever it may be. It might be a doctor that'll push him onto his counselor. You know, that counselor might push him into a treatment center, you know, or pre-treatment or whatever it may be. That was my that's how it worked for me. You know, there's so many different ways. So just as you said there, like, just there's hope. We are a testament that there's hope, like.
But look, it's a good way to finish.
Yeah,
lovely talk, and gentlemen, gentlemen, look forward to seeing you fight. Hopefully, in person, we might get to go to an event and sit ringside.
Absolutely,
that would be class.
The two Norris from ringside.
Timmy could be the security. But look, it was lovely talking, Sean. Best of luck with everything, the wedding, the boxing, and the degree.
Thank you.
Thanks very much,
gentlemen.
And we'll see everybody next week.
Thanks, everyone.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.